Dial, and K219KU, Nahalem, serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 on your FM dial. Streaming live and archived, baby, at xray.fm. Radio is yours.
It takes truly special people to work with students with special needs. Today we meet some of those talented professionals on this episode of The Common Good.
Hello and welcome to The Common Good, where we showcase the achievements of members of our community that contribute to Southwest Washington and beyond in a positive way.
Part 2 of 2 episodes, Stephen welcomes guest Nick Hernandez, the job coordinator for GATE, Margot Reston and McKenna Stack, speech and language pathologist, job coach Catherine Kellett, and our KXRW job coach Jasmine Stanley.
In the last episode, we kind of got a sense of, you know, who you were, and the kind of work you did, and we kind of touched on, for you know, the idea of forgetting about labels and worrying about what are the specific needs of students. Now, the reality is that all students have specific needs. Just some of them don't have a label. So what are some of the, and this is open to everybody now, what are some of the challenges that you've seen? What are some of the solutions for those challenges? Like if you say to somebody, it's like, somebody isn't good at such a thing, you know, and we do this. So like examples of that.
One of those I think that I've learned since I've been at GATE is just processing time for students. You can ask a question, give a direction, and some students just might need a little more time to process that. And if I or you know a supervisor doesn't allow that and repeats that instruction, it can just further that processing time. And so it's giving space for students to taking the question, the direction, and then process. And then often they'll just come out with the right answer or the right response. And it's just giving a safe space where they can take that time.
Do you ever have students and they come up, it's like they come up with a solution. It doesn't, they're not using the words that you would normally hear, but you're like, you know, come to think of it the way that you're stating that, that's a great way to think of this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they... I mean, our students are intelligent, they are hard workers, and they often will find a way to a solution or solving the problem, getting the job done. It might be something different than what we anticipated, but as long as you know the work is getting done and they're making improvements and trying their best, I think that's great.
Mm-hmm. Like, Margot, you were talking about learning as much from the, you know, learning from the students the same as that they're learning from you. What are some of the things you've learned from the students you work with?
Oh, I've learned that our students have an incredibly strong sense of social justice. I think that they see fairness, and they also, we work a lot on perspective taking too. And I think that that is good because we all have the perspective, not just us bestowing, you know, again, trying to influence a perspective, but just trying to ask what do they have to offer. I also noticed the power of repetition. I think that lots of times, you know, when we get to practice a skill over and over and over, you see that kind of ownership happen in the students. Then also getting them to develop this sense of who they are and kind of when they tell me, oh, you know, Ms. Mago, that's not helpful. And I'm like, oh my gosh, thank you so much for telling me. I won't do that. So
now, McKenna, you're autistic.
Yes.
You're dealing with, you're helping kids who are autistic. Mm-hmm. Is it easier to help kids who are autistic, or is it easier to help kids who are not autistic?
What a great question. I definitely think that I relate to autistic students more in a way that I never really expected until I realized how much I connect with autistic students. I think that with students that aren't autistic, you know, it goes back to what I was saying earlier of doesn't really matter what the disability is. I am just meeting a student where they're at and what their needs are. But I do feel like with my autistic students that, you know, there is such a, like, I'm bringing in my experience as an autistic person, so I know to read a room and see how neurodiversity affirming it is, for example, how, what kind of sensory things are happening and what a student might be feeling, and kind of anticipating those needs and not necessarily having that be the truth, but having that be an option, if that makes sense. So working through that. And making sure, again, that the student has their voice to say what they need in that environment. For example, thinking about a work environment that is really loud. And, you know, I can walk into that environment and know, because I'm autistic and my sensory needs are loud environments, I can think, oh, do I need to talk about this with my student? And how do I facilitate them to... accommodate themselves? You know, do they need a break? Do they need a sensory break? Do they need noise-canceling headphones for their work site?
All right. So this is a question I really have been wanting to ask.
Okay.
And I'm going to start with Catherine, but I want you to all answer this question. What are the most fun parts of your job?
See, I'm lucky in a sense that my job and my day is spent all 6 hours. Well, not all 6 hours. We're 4 hours. All 4 hours, I am with the students. I'm in the thick of it. You know, I'm in the conversations. I'm everywhere. And I think the most fun thing for me is to see the progression of a student over the time that we have. Because, you know, who somebody is their first year coming into the program is so different from where they end up, you know. And this is my fourth year working in this position. So the students that I started with are now this year graduating. And it's like night and day for some students to see, you know, a fresh 18-year-old coming into the classroom and they're like, I have no clue what I'm doing. I'm really struggling with regulation. I don't want to work. I just want to be a kid forever. And by the time that they turn 22, they are working full shifts. They are excited for their independence. They are stronger in their social connections with people. And they are also really proud of themselves. I think it's a huge moment to see a student feel good about themselves.
It sounds like one of the most important skills they learn is advocating for themselves.
Absolutely, absolutely. And learning the importance of boundaries too. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a lot of times where you're in this position and you think, okay, well, my job here is to learn how to do a job. But within that, you also kind of learn, okay, well, how do I have relationships with people in this job? How much is too much sharing? How much is not enough sharing? Who can I talk to? Who can I feel comfortable with? And just really having a better sense of yourself over the time that you've been here. And, you know, just how do you apply that to life?
And Nick, what would you say is the most fun part of your job? And you can't say it's going to get coffee.
That's mine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of it, but what are some other fun parts of the job?
I like being able to push students to go beyond what they're comfortable with in terms of trying a new work site. Often I'll get the idea of like, well, I've never done this, or I'm not sure if I can do this. And I can say, you know, just go give it a try, save space. And when they come back to me and just said, that was a really fun day, I enjoyed that. You know, recently I had a student, I said, I want you to try this commercial kitchen. I want you to try some baking. And he said, I've never done that before. I'm not in the kitchen. I said, I think this will be good for you. It expands your horizons. And within a couple of weeks, I visited the work site. I walked in. He said, hey, come here. Try this whipped cream. It's going to be the best whipped cream you've ever tasted in your life. And he was that confidence. And it was pretty good whipped cream, yeah. And so it's being able to see that in their eyes. And
It's one thing that's interesting is that a lot of general education is, oh, you know, I teach 11th grade English, and then the kid comes in, they finish 11th grade English. You never see them again, like ever. You don't even see them in the hallways passing by. You get to really see how things change. Mago, for you, mm-hmm. What's the most fun part of your job?
I think it's not dissimilar to Nick. I think that when we started to get into work sites this year, and as they progressed and became a little more comfortable with the work site, my favorite thing to do is go in and say, like, teach me your job. And they would walk me through steps of, like, at Yard and Garden or something, like, this is how you fill the bag. This is how you, nope, don't do it that way. and I kind of mimic them and want to, you know, shadow them. And I think it's so cool that they take the almost the teaching role and I'm following them. I'm learning and I'm like, wow, this is super cool.
Now, you're a speech pathologist and kids use a lot of inventive words. Mm-hmm. You pick up any good ones?
Oh, no. I wish I was better at like slang. I am not that good at it. In fact, when I try to ask what any of them mean, they just look at me blankly like, ugh. Okay.
6'7"
Yeah. And actually, I asked what 6'7" was, and all of them unanimously say, we don't actually know.
Yeah, nobody knows. So, McKenna, what would you say is the most fun part of your job?
I love connecting with my students. I just think they are some of the coolest people I have ever met.
It's working with the kids and seeing and just feeling that connection that really works for you.
It does. And the organic connection, you know, whether we are having lunch together or, you know, saying good morning to each other or catching up about something that happened at work that they're proud of or even like a struggle that they encountered at work. I just think that my moments of connections with students where they trust me with information is some of my favorite moments of my life.
And Nick, I have one question for you before we, and I haven't given you a lot of time for this, but would you say that kids that enter the program, if they had to go on and be out in the community at, you know, at work sites, you know, getting jobs, finding places to live, do you think that they would succeed without the GATE program?
I think we are an important bridge to that. We do have students who have paid work, even in the program, and we allow that. If they have a paid job, they can certainly do that and still be in the program. But I think what we do is we provide that meaningful connection in terms of this is who you are in your community. You have an important voice. You can contribute in a meaningful way. And we provide on-the-job training for that. And so I think what we do is we serve an important bridge to allow them to gain those skills, to be as independent as possible for them. And we're excited when they graduate. And if they volunteer or at paid work, it's always awesome to see them take what they learned here and that confidence that we've, I think, instilled, which is, I think, what all of our staff does, is try to build their confidence up to know that they have an important contribution to society.
So people in Vancouver and Clark County should know that you're unleashing a whole bunch of kids who are really ready to be a part of the society, work, you know, everything.
Definitely.
So we have 10 seconds. Does anybody have something really, really insightful to say in the last 10 seconds?
We work with adults.
Yes.
That's what's insightful is they're not just kids. They're full adults.
They're adults.
Everybody who's younger than 40 is a kid.
There you go.
Well, thanks for coming in. When we come back, we're going to talk to Jasmine, who's been the job coach at this location for this year. But thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us. Our pleasure.
You're listening to The Common Good on KXRW Vancouver 99.9 FM with today's host, Stephen Glickman. His guests today are Nick Hernandez, the Jobs Coordinator for GATE, Mago Weston and McKenna Stack, who are the Speech Language Pathologist, Job Coach Catherine Kellett, and our KXRW Job Coach, Jasmine Stanley. We've been talking to Nick, Catherine, Mago, and McKenna about their experiences with the program. When we return, we will continue our discussion with Jasmine Stanley.
Support for KXRW comes from On Point Community Credit Union, with 8 branches in Southwest Washington offering checking, credit cards, home equity lines of credit, and more. On Point. People are the point. Federally insured by NCUA. Equal housing opportunity. Learn more at onpointcu.com.
Support for KXRW comes from Kindred Vancouver in the Uptown Village neighborhood. Kindred is a community-focused general store offering bulk refillery options and supplies for sustainable, do-it-yourself living. With a focus on reducing waste and supporting clean, mindful lifestyles, Kindred helps individuals incorporate low-impact choices into daily life. More information is at kindredvancouver.com.
Oh, Welcome back to the Common Good on KXRW Vancouver 99.9 FM. Your host for this episode is Stephen Glickman, and his guests today are Nick, Michael, McKenna, Catherine, and Jasmine, who are all educators working in and with Vancouver School District's GATE program. Our discussions continue with KXRW job coach Jasmine Stanley.
Jasmine, you, I would say welcome to the studio normally, but you're here every Tuesday. Yep. And you're helping out with GATE. And I saved us some time for you, especially because you've been kind of our star player. You're the job coach for this location this year, and you've been helping the kids out. And were you doing it? You were last year. You were doing
Yes, last year as well.
Yeah. So you really have gotten some expertise in helping the kids emotionally and intellectually, working through all their stuff. Mm-hmm. So considering that you're such a rock star with this, we got to get to, you know, your backstory.
Okay.
And so, did you start out in paraeducation?
So I didn't actually. I came to paraeducation kind of more of a winding path, but I. Pre-COVID shutdowns, I worked in movie theaters for about 13 years. Then shutdowns happened and movie theaters were not open, so I was unemployed for a little bit, which led me into elder care. And then through there, some friends I had that worked in the school system were like, why don't you check out paraeducation, you know? And yeah, so I did, and I love it. So,
what was your educational background that led you to being able to do that?
So I just have a high school background. I didn't have any college, but there's proficiency tests to get into the position, and yeah, that was it.
It's one of those things where it's very vocational. You do the work, get to do the work.
Exactly, yeah. And I would say just from experience, like working in movie theaters, I had already had sort of a basis of working with younger people, with working with teenagers, and kind of teaching those life skills, just by way of being a manager at a theater. You know, you kind of.
So how long have you been a paraeducator?
This is my fifth year, yeah.
If I could just say paraeducator. It's a tough word.
No, it is.
What are some of the surprises that about being a paraeducator for you? What are some of the things you didn't really, you know, that you're like, wow, I wouldn't have thought of that?
Yeah. Well, I think just because it wasn't something I had originally considered until someone suggested it, I felt at first kind of nervous that I wouldn't be able to do it. It just seems sort of daunting in a way. But so I guess that was a bit of a surprise getting into it and realizing like how suited I was for the position. Otherwise, I guess how rewarding it is. I kind of knew it would be, but it's been a lot more rewarding work than I expected it to be. So that's been very nice.
So your strength coming into it was that you cared.
Yeah.
It seems as though would you say that empathy is something that you highly value?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I had received feedback in that realm in my previous positions where people would say I was really good at like navigating difficult situations between employees and things like that. And
just you've been able to work with me.
Hey.
I mean, that can't get any more difficult than that. What would you say are some of the really fun things that you've experienced in the GATE program?
Just every day working with students, I really enjoy that. It's nice to be helpful in that sort of difficult space in life where you're growing up and you're suddenly like facing responsibilities you haven't had before. Being able to, support people going through that is just really, really rewarding. I love it.
So you're like almost in the room where it happens.
Yeah,
It's like you're a star of Hamilton.
You get to see it happen. It's really great. You'll see someone struggle with a particular thing, and then 3 months later, they're doing it like it's nothing, and just seeing that growth is really inspiring. Yeah.
Do you feel like you've gotten better at it?
Yes, absolutely. I think at first I was a little unsure, or certain things I'd be a little more maybe shy in approaches with people, but yeah, now I feel a little more confident in my ability to navigate things, and yeah.
Is there something that you would think that maybe the general public doesn't know that you've seen firsthand that you're like, people should know this?
Yeah, I would say both from the job and also from having friends previously that experienced disabilities, I would say the main thing is just underestimating people with disabilities. Like, I see that a lot, and people are capable of all kinds of things, and it's good to give people a chance, I think.
So in some cases, the disabilities are, hey, you just have to know that this exists and you have to work around that the same way that you'd have to do that with just about anybody.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I grew up with a friend who only had, she was born with just one arm and one leg. So I just knew, okay, she needs a little bit of mobility assistance throughout the day. That's it. Easy enough, you know? Yeah.
That, well, that's really, that's a lot. I mean, especially if you see that when you're younger, it, you know.
I was very lucky with that. Yeah.
When I grew up, especially, you know, disability was almost like something to be ashamed of.
Yeah.
I think now it's just, like, hey, you just need to know this so we can navigate.
Yeah, we've got all kinds of different people with different abilities, and yeah.
What would you say is the biggest challenge that you faced as a paraeducator in the GATE program?
I would say something that can be challenging is that we are out in the public quite a lot, so that is different from, like, a general education setting. So just managing, being aware of, like, safety and stuff as you're moving through the community. We do a lot of public transit, so just making sure I'm keeping track of every student we have and nobody's lost and nobody's, you know, running into dangerous situations in the community and things like that. But,
is it hard to avoid problems? Where, you know, is it hard to maintain safety, or is it actually pretty easy?
Yeah, it's pretty easy. It just takes, you know, we always say keep your head on a swivel, so it's just a matter of, like, being aware of where you are in the community and, make sure you're not going to go trip on that open pit in the street from construction workers or
What do you see is the future for paraeducation? Like, is there something that needs to change within GATE, you think, or is there something that needs to change within paraeducation?
Yeah, gosh, that's a good question. I feel pretty confident in the way our program handles things. So it's hard to think of critique I have there. But I guess going back again to just knowing that students have maybe more ability than you're initially thinking. I have seen, you know, instances where people were maybe, and well, and I've been guilty of this myself, like maybe doing too much for a student, trying to be too helpful. And it's like, you know, we got to encourage some independence and,
So you're, as someone who's in the GATE program, as a paraeducator, it sounds like you feel pretty confident about the abilities of the program, the people that you work alongside of in the program. What are some of the things that you see as, you know, that you've seen your coworkers and the people that you work with, you know, that you're, like, really impressed with?
Gosh, yeah. I would say abilities around communication. I think our team is really good at sharing our insights with each other and also taking critique really well, you know, so we're all very comfortable telling each other, hey, you know, I saw this and I think that they're dealing with this a little more, so maybe we can adjust our approach here, you know, and we're all very open to hearing critique, open to sharing it. And what I've been impressed by, I think mostly just the ideas people come up with this to problem solve. Sometimes I'm like, I would have never thought of that. Perfect.
You have an example of that?
I know. Gosh. Mostly it's been in, like, communication. I'm trying to think of a specific example. But, like, say, you know, I'm often someone who's maybe got a lot of words. So I like to talk through problems maybe too much. But then someone will suggest, you know what, that student gets a little overwhelmed by too much communication. So I'm like, okay. I can adjust and, you know, use fewer words.
Do you have a background at all in performing? Do you ever, were you like a theater kid in high school or anything?
That's so funny. You should ask. Yes, I was a theater kid in middle school, more a little bit into high school, and then I got into more visual arts, but yeah.
And did that background help you in what you're doing now?
Yeah, I definitely think the process of acting and having to put yourself in someone else's shoes is really helpful to understand other people. Those skills have definitely served me well. Yeah.
Is there anything that you would want the public to know about what you're doing as a paraeducator or just the GATE program in general?
Yeah. I think the program is just really great and should be honestly available more widely to all kinds of students. Just getting that extra, you know, foot up in the world when you're trying to figure out, like, oh, how do I balance a checkbook? How do I, you know, hold a job, find an apartment? Those are skills that a lot of young people just go into the world without much knowledge about, and they just kind of have to figure it out. So
I can't think of a single, I always struggle with the word for it, you know, mainstream or, you know, but, like, who's a kid who doesn't need to know those things?
Yeah, who doesn't?
I mean, I think that, you know, what kid shouldn't know about how to manage their money? What kid shouldn't know about how to write a resume or how to get a job? I mean, these are all.
I think all of them do. Yeah.
So would you say that there are skills that you focus on very front of mind in GATE that actually could translate to all education?
Yeah. Let's think. So I would say just self-regulation, being able to manage your feelings about how your life is moving is very important. How to do the things that are hard, but we know we need to do to have a better outcome later. So like things like filling out job applications, going to interviews. It's not very comfortable, but it's really important to know to have a better future.
How much of the GATE time is in classroom versus mm-hmm. out in the community?
So we're mostly on the community. We're definitely focused on job preparation and life skills, but we do have academics as well, but I would say that's...
So it's kind of a very applied thing. It's like, yeah. Hey, this is how you live your life.
Yeah, yeah. And so our academics are also very tied to that. So like assignments will be things like fill out a bus schedule. We're trying to go here. How do you get there if you use public transit? Or, you know, mock interviews we do every year. So you have like a fake interview process so that you know how to do that when you're doing it in real life. Yeah.
So it's in what I'm hearing is the GATE faculty mm-hmm. works together very closely, shares a lot of information. Mm-hmm. Would you say that in a traditional high school that that's the case?
Yeah, it'd be hard for me to say because I haven't worked in a traditional high school, but I do think because we're a smaller program, certain matters of communication are a little easier because we're a smaller team. But yeah.
And when you came in, were you given kind of warnings? Hey, look out for this. This is a common pitfall, that kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah. We receive a good amount of training ahead just about things that might show up with certain disabilities and how to be prepared for those. Best practices in responding to those things. So we get some good training on like if, say, someone has issues with emotional regulation, how to best approach that and get them back to baseline and calm.
So the most important question before we mm-hmm. wrap up is you're going to be back here next year helping out the students as a job coach at KXRW?
Yeah, as far as I know, yeah.
Is there something that you think of, well, like at this job site, is there something that you think of, I want to make sure this gets done? This is something that now that you're in your second year, getting close to the end of it, is there something that you're thinking like, hey, I think that students, what they can get out of this particular program and are you starting to kind of formalize that in your head?
Yeah. I definitely think the being part of an interview process is also a very good skill that we hadn't yet done before. Yeah. And I really look forward to having them conduct interviews, things like that, be the interviewee. I think that's another skill that could be improved. It's been a really good experience all around.
That's great. Well, thanks for being available for this program and talking a little bit about yourself. And now you get to just listen back to yourself a whole bunch of times while we edit this.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening today to The Common Good on KXRW Vancouver 99.9 FM. I'm your host, Stephen Glickman, and I'd like to thank my guests, Nick Hernandez, the jobs coordinator for GATE, Mago Weston and McKenna Stack, who are speech-language pathologists, job coach Catherine Kellett, and KXRW job site coach Jasmine Stanley. You can visit kxrw.fm and click on The Common Good to find part one of this show. Programming like this is made possible by your generous support. If you'd like to support this program and others like it, please visit us on the web at kxrw.fm, and there you'll find the big donate button. Together, we're discovering Vancouver's voice. On behalf of show creator and producer Joe Clemens and all the volunteers and supporters who make this program possible, I'm host Stephen Glickman, and I want to thank you for listening to The Common Good. Take care.
With an increase in attacks against marginalized communities, the ACLU of Oregon strives to rise to the challenges of the times and be an inclusive, resilient, and functional country. They work in courts, in the legislature, and in communities to protect and advance civil rights and liberties. The ACLU of Oregon is committed to centering the individuals and communities historically excluded by institutions and systems in the creation of a more just, equitable, and caring state. They work so our democracy can better serve all people. More information at aclu-or.org.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from Spielman Bagels and Coffee. Opened by Rick Spielman and his son, Raf, Spielman's has been serving handmade boiled and baked bagels and house-roasted coffee since 2011 in their flagship store located on Southeast 20th and Division Street. More information and hours at spielmanbagels.com.
Welcome to Policy for the People, a show that explores the public policies that can lift up all Oregonians. This show is a collaboration between KMUZ Radio and the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I am your host, Juan Carlos Ordóñez. During the depths of the COVID pandemic a few years back, many workers decided to put their foot down about poor wages and working conditions. They began organizing the workplace at a pace not seen in quite a long time. Across the country, workers succeeded in forming unions at companies that once seemed out of reach, companies like Starbucks and Amazon. Unions are essential for having an economy that works for everyone, not just the wealthy few. Unions help workers secure better pay and benefits. And it's not just union members who benefit. The presence of unions in an industry raises wages and job standards for everyone, unionized or not. So where do things stand right now in Oregon? How active are workers in trying to organize the workplace? In this episode of Policy for the People, we examine the current state of worker organizing in Oregon. My colleague from the Oregon Center for Public Policy, Kathy Lotta, discusses what the latest data shows. As she explains, by several measures, worker organizing remains at high levels, even as they confront the same barriers that make it difficult for workers to unionize the workplace. But we begin the episode with the story of a tight-knit team of workers in Eugene, Oregon, who overcame those barriers and succeeded in unionizing their workplace. My colleague Jesslyn Lemke spoke with three workers at Serenity Hospice about their decision to fight for a union. Here is their story.
A team of determined hospice care workers in Eugene recently signed their first union contract. Serenity Hospice in Eugene is a tight-knit office of 22 workers, mostly women. Hospice care is tough work. It's long hours caring for patients who are dying. It's dealing with and comforting distraught families. And in the case of Serenity Hospice in Eugene, this work also came with low pay and difficult working conditions. In 2024, the workers had enough. They petitioned to form a union. But that was only part of the journey. It took two more years to finally reach a union contract with Addis Home Care, the billion-dollar company that owns Serenity. Negotiating and reaching an agreement with one's employer often is the hardest and longest stage in the process of making a union. Despite the pressure put on them by Addis Home Care, they finally succeeded in signing their first union contract in March of this year, officially becoming an SEIU 503 union.
A lot of times when you have, so when we have patients that are actively dying, they require daily visits. And there are times when you're walking into families that are in crisis. So you're walking into this day after day after day, meeting the needs and trying to do the best you can. And sometimes it's hard. It is hard.
That's Nancy Giesen, a licensed practical nurse with Serenity. She began working with Serenity in the period before they began to unionize. Nancy works long hours directly with dying clients on hospice care, helping them with medication, bandages, and other end-of-life concerns. It's hard work, not just physically, but emotionally as well.
I mean, having very long days, seeing patients back to back to back to back, you know, and then the long nights charting, and then getting up, rolling into the next day.
Nancy noticed that many of her coworkers were struggling with the same problems.
Some of the complaints that I was hearing, especially from the salaried employees, is that there was just unfair compensation. the amount of hours that are required from the salaried employees is, it's burdensome. And by the time you break it down, they were earning less than the hourly employees. And not only was that grossly unfair, but then the older employees with more experience were also being paid less than the ones who were incoming with less experience. So it was just rubbing salt into the wound. The trend continued with newer employees were being hired at market wages.
We were, you know, $10 and $15 below everyone else in this area wage-wise, and we weren't asking for tremendous raises. We just wanted more than 1% of where we were sitting at.
That is Dewana Tarpio, an assistant manager at Serenity. Struggling with low wages, she and her staff raised the issue of their low pay with Addis Home Care, the company that owns Serenity.
We would tell them how important a wage increase was for us and how mileage wasn't enough. And we kept asking them, like, there's got to be more than this. We weren't getting adequate raises. They were minimal to like 1% if we got them that year. And our president and our vice president continued to kind of shoo us to the side. They came in with prepared speeches, would never want to answer our questions. I love these patients, but it's really hard to go home and not be able to provide for your family.
Fed up, the workers at Serenity began to organize. In 2024, all of the workers at the facility signed a petition and presented their executive director with that and a formal letter. But that wasn't the end of the story, because petitioning to form a union is just the first step in the process. After that comes another difficult, often time-consuming step, reaching a union contract with the employer through negotiations. But instead of voluntarily recognizing their union, Addis Home Care began applying pressure, sending daily emails to the workers at Serenity, discouraging them from unionizing. But the workers were undeterred. They used a group thread to continue organizing and to encourage one another. The negotiating team met at Starbucks regularly. This is how Dewana describes what came next.
We were mostly worried about being fired or that they would just shut the office down, because we're not a huge office. We're an office of, you know, 22 people. So we really were like, there's only 22 of us compared to this billion-dollar company. They could just let us go. They tried to separate who out of the whole office might be unionized, who couldn't be unionized. Then we would get emails every day, sometimes twice a day, in our work, emails that were very against unionizing. That the anti-union lawyers went to the other two offices and had meetings with them. I think they were afraid that we were trying to unionize every office they owned in the state, which we weren't. We were just worried about the 22 of us here. It took us 2 years to actually ratify. And I think it was probably a year and a half before we realized that the lawyer that was coming in to bargain with us was going to actually be serious. They postponed a lot of things. The weather, the flights. I can't this month. And we spent a lot of back and forth for a very long time. And it was probably a year and a half in before we were like, no, this is moving. It's moving forward. We're really going to do this. But we just kept sticking with it.
And they succeeded. In March of this year, the workers at Serenity won their first union contract.
I think we all cried. Literally, I did. It was such a relief because we had put so much time of our own personal time outside of work. Due to the union and being ratified now, we have an immense package that everyone who comes here has higher wages, covered health care, and 90% of federal gas mileage reimbursement. I know for myself, I went from $29 to $43 an hour. That I think we did the math on that, and it was around 60% increase. Most people seen 33% increases in their wages. We all got 100% coverage for our healthcare premiums.
Another bargaining team member, Deb McLaughlin, a social worker with Serenity who counsels dying patients and their families, says the long struggle to form a union paid off.
Absolutely. My pay and my benefits have been influenced by the union. I started at this job at $30 an hour. I've been a social worker for 20 years. And now, after we unionized, I'm at $43 an hour. That is a huge increase. We chose to stay because we believed in each other. And now we get to believe in each other and get paid well. And that's priceless. It really is.
Duana's message for other workers in Oregon looking to break out of their working conditions and form a union is simple.
To let other people who want to start a union or be unionized I would just like to tell them to not be afraid. That if you want your voice heard, this is one of the biggest steps that you can make to do that. And not allow a company to make them feel like it's you against them. Because it's not you against them. You're trying to better yourself for them.
The success of workers in unionizing Serenity Hospice is one example of the wave of unionizing efforts that followed in the wake of the COVID pandemic. Recent years have seen increased levels of worker organizing across many industries. But does that heightened level of worker organizing remain in place? Where do things stand today? To explore that question, I spoke with my colleague at the Oregon Center for Public Policy, Kathy Latta. Kathy is a policy analyst at the center, which she researches issues related to worker power. Here's my conversation with Kathy. Hi, Kathy. How are you?
I'm good, Juan Carlos. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So you recently published a paper examining the state of labor activity here in Oregon. How would you summarize the findings of your report?
I would say that we both have some positive news and also some not so positive news when it comes to the state of worker or labor organizing in Oregon. So the first thing to note, the positive news is that the level of worker organizing that we saw first start during the pandemic or increase during that pandemic is generally still in place. So that's really good news. This plus other data that we see tells us that workers are still in favor of unions, right? So they're still, unions are viewed very positively by workers. But the not so good news is that union density, or like the percent or the proportion of workers that belong to unions in Oregon, has really not budged in quite a bit. And so that's really connected to the fact that workers still face barriers when it comes to joining or forming their unions today.
I want to break all that down and kind of dive deeper into the data. But before we do that, maybe we can just talk a little bit about the benefits of unions. Why are unions good for workers, and what advantages do they provide?
I think the most important thing to first note, the most basic thing, is unions give workers a voice. Usually when people go to work, you're not really in a position to dictate the terms and conditions of your employment. It's you go to work and the employer tells you, these are the terms and conditions, these are the wages and benefits, and that's it. But that's not the case when you're in a union. The union is a vehicle that workers have in order to negotiate something different, in order to have a say in those terms and conditions of work that may be related to wages, benefits, safety standards, and other conditions. So it gives them a voice to not just accept things as they are, but have an ability to negotiate with the employer for changes in those employment conditions. The second thing to note is that when you are part of a union as well, when you have a collective bargaining agreement, you also have job security, right? Job protection. So when we live in a at-will country, right? Meaning employers can have the ability to discipline or fire you for any or all reasons or no reason at all, as long as it's not related to a protected characteristic like your race or your gender. But that changes when you have a union contract and job protection, right? There is just cause in place, which is a transparent protocol that employers have to follow, that when they need to discipline or terminate an employer, that they have to have a valid reason in order to do so and have the proportionate discipline connected to that infraction of the employee. So that's, you know, another sense, that another benefit that they have, you know, a certain level of job security or job protection as well. I think we also should remember that union members also tend to have employer-provided healthcare, right? Compared to non-union workers, union workers are more likely to have employer-provided healthcare. And those union employers also tend to pay more into that employer-provided healthcare. And just one other thing to note, union workers tend to have higher wages than non-union workers, right? I think in general, union workers tend to make around 12.8% more in wages compared to non-union workers. And again, that has to do with the fact that they have leverage to negotiate terms and conditions of employment. It's not one single worker asking, hey, can I get a raise? It's everyone collectively. And so when you have that kind of power or leverage, workers can ask for more.
What do we know about how the public perceives unions? Do they see them favorably? What's the general perception of the public?
The latest research done by Gallup, they conducted a poll last year. And I want to say that about 68% of the population views unions in a positive light, very favorably. And so that's more than half of the population is really supportive or view unions in a very positive light.
Let's go back to something you said at the beginning, which is that the level of worker organizing here in Oregon has tended to be fairly healthy, at least in recent years. There's been quite a bit of activity. Can you dive a little bit deeper into that? What are we seeing?
Yeah, so the data tells us that when it comes to workers seeking union election, there's been an increase. Union election just means when workers get together, they file petition with the National Labor Relations Board in order to hold an election so that voters in that particular workplace can vote for a union. I'm really talking about all the workers that we see in that election process on a yearly basis. And we've seen this grow starting in the pandemic. Before the pandemic, we could see around just under 1,700 workers a year seeking to have a union election or to organize. And so that changed during the pandemic when more workers started to seek more union elections, right? It grew from that average yearly rate of 1,700 to, I believe, 3,100 in 2022 to 3,800 in 2023, right? So there's an increase that we started to see, and that increase has continued as well. If we look at just 2025 figures, we saw that 5,600 workers wanted to unionize that year alone. And so that's a significant increase, right? That's a 47% increase from just 2023 to 2025 alone. So, you know, we did see more workers wanting to join unions in 2025. So that was a peak year for us.
And Kathy, you also spoke about some bad news, that the levels of unionization, the share of workers belonging to unions, is not looking so good. Can you flesh that out for us?
I want to flesh it out like at the state level and at the national level too, because there's a difference. So in Oregon, we see that the union density, and again, the proportion of workers belonging to unions, has remained relatively unchanged from the beginning of the millennium, right? In 2000, it was around 15.7% of the population belong to unions. Just last year in 2025, that's around 15.1. So it hasn't really changed through all that time. Yes, we can say there's been fluctuations, but on average, Oregon has been really consistent in staying around that 15% level. But it's a different story when you look at national level data. So in the U.S. as a whole, if we start at in the year 2000 and what that union membership was like, it was around 13% of the population, or 13% of workers belong to unions. 25 years later, in 2025, that has gone down to 10% of workers belonging to unions. So it's been a steady but slow decline in union membership for the country as a whole since 2000, which is, of course, part of a larger decline that we've seen in this country since the union heyday in the 1940s, when union membership was at 33%.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Policy for the People. I'm speaking with Kathy Latta of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and we're discussing the state of worker organizing in Oregon. Here is the rest of our conversation. So we discussed earlier how unions are popular. A large majority of the public views them favorably. And yet, as you just mentioned, the levels of unionization are fairly low by historical standards. And what explains that disconnect? What's behind that, the fact that the levels of unionization don't match with their popularity?
One of the biggest obstacles to this is the fact that workers face barriers in terms of employer opposition and employer intimidation when it comes to them trying to form or join their union. So, for example, employers engage in a variety of anti-union behaviors to stop or to try and convince their workers to not to join their union, right? And this has They use a variety of tactics. One is using captive audience meetings, where employers get their employees together in a meeting and try to persuade them, you know, not to join the union. And usually this is done under some type of duress or implied threats, right, of discharge or discipline that can happen if they join. Employers might threaten certain loss of wages or benefits for workers who want to join a union, or might do the opposite, and promise more wages or benefits if they don't join the union. Employers also engage in surveillance or spy on their workers. They might use an employee's social media account to spy on them. So, in addition to that, we know that this type of behavior is not a one-off; it's systemic. According to national level research, we see that employers break federal law or violate federal law 41% of the time during union elections. So this is a consistent pattern that employers are engaging in. You can take a look at the penalties. There is very low level or lack of penalties when it comes to when employers retaliate against their workers when they engage in concerted activities. So it's not really a deterrent. And the last thing to mention is that employers are heavily invested in engaging in these kinds of activities. I think research shows that employers invest around $400 million a year just to stop workers from engaging in the protected concerted activities or from joining unions.
What's happening with federal labor law? Because there is a law called the National Labor Relations Act that is supposed to protect the right to unionize. Why isn't that ensuring that workers actually fulfill their desires to form a union?
Yeah, I mean, to that, I will say that a lot of research academics have said that labor law needs to be fixed, right? It needs to make it easier for workers to organize, limit employer hostility or intimidation when it comes to this. And there's been avenues to try and do that as well. There's been efforts to pass legislation like the PRO Act, which it would intend to do just that, make it easier for workers to join their union, try to limit or reduce employer hostility or intimidation, and increase penalties so they're de-incentivized to not break federal labor law.
Beyond fixing federal law, which seems in a fundamental way fairly broken, are there things that we can do here in Oregon at the state level to address some of these problems that workers are facing when it comes to forming unions?
Yeah, I think there's plenty that Oregon can do. One, I think we should make sure we extend bargaining or organizing rights to historically excluded workers. We should remember that the National Labor Relations Act, the act that protects worker rights to organize in the private sector, to unionize in the private sector, historically excluded domestic workers and ag workers because of a racist compromise to pass the bill. So we have categories of these workers excluded. And it also excludes gig workers or independent contractors from organizing. So we have groups of workers excluded from this right. And so what Oregon can do is extend these organizing rights to these historically excluded workers so they have a chance to partake in these same rights that other workers do. Oregon can also consider establishing workforce standards boards. Workforce standard boards are just public bodies made up of workers, employers, and the public that come together that work to set industry minimum standards. They work together to set minimum standards for an entire sector or industry at a time. And so what that means is that there's certain costs to employers at an industry that become equalized, right? All employers have to follow the same labor and labor costs and other workplace costs. And so when you have those kinds of conditions, employers are de-incentivized to, you know, stop unionization efforts since they're not at a competitive disadvantage compared to the other firms. And lastly, I would also say that Oregon can extend just cause protections to workers, right? I think I've mentioned before that union workers work under just cause protections. They don't work under at will, right? Which is the majority of what workers work under, at will protections, meaning they can be fired for any and all or no reason at all. And so this is really detrimental because this undermines workers' ability to exercise their organizing rights when they can just be fired for any and all reasons. It's up to the worker to prove that, hey, they were fired for engaging in their legally protected concerted activities. But extending just cause protections will shift that dynamic so that instead of just allowing employers that ability, there would be standards in place where employers would need a good and valid reason to discipline or discharge their employee, which would allow workers more freedom to exercise their rights.
Kathy, any final thoughts you want to share with us regarding the state of unions here in Oregon and also ways that that situation may improve?
Yeah, I mean, number one, I want to say that we've seen a record number of workers organizing in 2025, and we should be really proud of that fact that more and more workers are seeking unions and want to join unions. And so we should really be proud of the fact that in the face of a lot of diversity, workers continue to organize, and that we hopefully see more of this organizing next year and the years after that. I think in general as well, if we want to see a more equitable society, a society where the average person has a voice and power, we really need to support workers in having or joining unions of their choosing. We know historically the benefits of unions, higher wages, better benefits, and having a voice in the workplace. And so if we want households, if we want families to thrive, it's important that we allow workers to have a say in their workplace.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Policy for the People. We will see you next time.
Support for X-Ray comes from New Deal Distillery. Find small batch craft spirits, bottled cocktails, local mixers, beer, wine, and more at New Deal Distillery and Bottle Shop, located in the Central East Side at 900 Southeast Salmon Street. More information at newdealdistillery.com.
For nearly 50 years, the Native American Youth and Family Center has helped the Native community create pathways to self-empowerment, offering education, family support services, and cultural programming to the large and diverse Native American population living in the greater Portland area. NAIA's wide range of wraparound programs include their alternative high school, the Many Nations Academy, which helps Native students achieve educational success. They also provide services for revered elders, foster youth, younger children, and their families. NAIA is answering Portland's housing problem by creating new affordable housing units and providing community members with training to find their paths to homeownership. NAIA also works to uplift Native representation as they help nurture the next generation of Indigenous leaders through leadership development and civic engagement. Community support will help them continue impacting the lives of 10,000 people each year. For more information, visit naiapdx.org.
Tune in every Thursday from 2